Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Peter McCombie. How are you, Peter?
I'm extremely well today. It's cold outside, but we're warm inside.
Here we are, warm inside, and it's snowy. This is in the Beast of the East.
Beast of the East, yep.
Yeah, in the middle of it. So I've come into London, and train was delayed, and all sorts of stuff, but we got here Surprisingly quickly.
Very good.
We're in Tooting Bec. Is it Tooting Bec?
Yeah,
or would
Tooting
you like
Bec.
To say Balham or
it's well, now that Tooting is officially one of the 10 coolest neighbourhoods in the world according to Lonely Planet, we're all in Tooting Bec.
Excellent. So, Peter, you're a master of wine, and you're one of the judges at Cellars in the Skies, as well as the International Wine Challenge.
Yep.
You do all sorts of bits and pieces. So I thought what we'd do is we're going to do a wee interview about yourself and talk a wee bit about restaurants and wine lists and all sorts of things. And then next week, I think we'll get into talking a wee bit about judging wines for Cellars in the Sky and what you look for in the air and how the airplane changes things and all those sort of crazy stuff. But listeners may not know this. You're not a South African or an Aussie. You're a Kiwi.
Yep. So still have a Kiwi passport.
Still have a Kiwi passport, and you're a master of wine. Did you come to the UK with an MW?
Or no,
did
I came here to do it.
Oh, you came to
I spent my 20s, I always joke about saying I was a bum, but I did a lot of sailing, and I wasn't really sure what I was doing. And I had a chance encounter with someone back in New Zealand, in Auckland, over dinner. A woman I've been sailing with and her ex-boss and his wife, and I'm going blah, 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 talking about wine because I was getting enthusiastic. And this woman I'd never met before and never seen since said to me, why don't you go back to London and do some exams? And it was like the light bulb above the head, and it was like, oh, yeah, that's what I should do.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I did, and I realized I needed to go maybe further than I thought originally and do the Master of Wine. And, you know, when you're younger, you think you're indestructible, so it didn't really occur to me to think hard about how difficult it was. I just thought, well, I can do this, and
off you
got
went.
Into it.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, so you came to London, and did you start off doing WCT?
Yep, I did. What we now call Level 3, and then went straight into diploma. And because I felt I'd, should we say, messed around a bit, I knocked it out in a year, which they don't really encourage, but I felt I could do it. I wanted to get on.
Were you full-time?
I just did it around a job. And then I was, some of that time I was working for Norman Foster, the architect, running a catering operation. But then I ended up working for a company called Wine Cellars.
Okay.
Which was probably the first UK wine company to take Italian wine seriously that wasn't run by Italians. So I worked for Nick Belfridge, Master of Wine, David Gleave, Master of Wine, and then I had a colleague, Tony Brown, who was also a Master of Wine. So we were a tiny little company with three Masters of Wine, and then when I passed, there were four. But it was a great place to learn, particularly about Italy, which remains, for me, country I love. I love the wines, I love everything about it. So that was great. And that was my first proper wine job in the UK.
Okay. So how long did it take you to do your MW?
From the time I started it, I did it pretty fast, a couple of years. Those days, you could sit in the first year, whereas now they want you to sit an assessment and they deliberately stagger it. But I passed the theory on the first go and then passed the tasting on the second go. So
nice.
Yeah, it was great, actually.
We've got a little dog in here. Well, not a really small dog. A Kiwi, so he looks like he's wearing a sheepskin rug, isn't he?
He does, yeah. What's he's a Samoyed. Name? Trusky.
Trusky the Samoyed, so he might bark every now and then.
Yeah.
But hopefully not. We've just fed him, so he's, I think he's
calm. Looking at the snow with
desire.
Desire, yeah.
Excellent. So now, what do you do now? You're living in London, you're in Tooting Bec, etc.
Wine Cellars was bought by a company called Inotria, and they merged two companies together, and we had a fantastic culture. I think the smaller company brought a rigor about wine quality, and Inotria had a really good business. They actually were efficient, they had great customer service, and actually they made money, and we didn't actually make money. So that was a really, really great time. And then I shifted. I was in sales, and I went to work for Bibendum for 5 years. I was running a sales team at Bibendum, selling to on premium on trade in London. Then I went freelance.
When was that?
That was 2001.
Okay, so quite a while outside of Pimpinden.
And at the time, the sales job I was doing, there was an element of consultancy anyway, you know, giving customers advice. And I had somebody who was paying me to do it. And when I went freelance, I immediately had two or three other people paying me. And I guess for me, having a background in sales was really important, because I kind of think wineries have to be seen as a commercial thing. They've got to be successful for the end user. I think sometimes people who take wine seriously can be a little bit focused on themselves and maybe on their peers, and they kind of want to do a really impressive wine list. And I actually think a good wine is a list that works for customers. So obviously I work for my clients, but really I'm aiming at their customers, because I want someone to pick up a wine list and not feel stupid and not feel like they don't know anything or they don't know where to begin.
Yeah, yeah.
So it involves maybe a mixture of familiar wines and hopefully something a bit challenging, something a bit different. But I'm not embarrassed about putting things like Pinot Grigio or Chablis on a wine list, because they're wines that people like to drink and they feel comfortable ordering. And if people want to drink them, then I think my job is to find the best ones I can, or the best value for money in those categories. And then you can salt a list with things that are maybe a little more funky and challenging.
Yeah, 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 okay. So I'm surprised you said Chablis, though. I would have thought Chablis was pretty much a normal mainstay.
Well, it is. But I guess that's what I mean, that you know, when I was younger, maybe I would go, oh, Chablis, it's so boring. But actually, the truth is, good Chablis is delicious and extremely versatile.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of food matching, and it's something people feel comfortable with. You know, people think, "Oh, I know what that is. I'll have that." So you might say, "Well, that's a safe, boring choice." But lots of the time, that's what people want. And I don't have a problem with that. I think it's great to be passionate about wine. It's great to be exploring in wine, but not everybody wants to do that. And I think it's really important to recognize that wine is something that maybe for some people is a bit intimidating.
What about, you know, you go to some restaurants and they bring out the tomb.
The Bible.
The wine list. And, you know, I know about wine and I still get put off by looking at something like that.
Well, yeah, I have respect for those lists, but I'm not particularly interested in making them. I think I'll give you an example. My wife and I have some friends who we eat and drink with in various places quite a lot. And the other husband is a very keen amateur of wine. And when we get a big wine list, our wives roll their eyes. It's like, oh, God, here we go, you know, 15 minutes later.
Yeah. But why don't they just order a bottle of wine? They'll have that while you're choosing
exactly,
the next one.
Exactly. So I guess I actually really don't like the word curate. People say it seems to be an American thing, you know, I curate wine lists. But actually, in a certain usage, I think, I mean, it sounds pretentious, but in a way, that's what I want people to do. Like, if you've got a big cellar, but choose some wines from your cellar and present people a short list. You know, why? I know a restaurant in London that last time I looked had 20 Mersos on the list. I don't think that's helping the customer. I think you know, maybe you have one that's relatively forward and maybe more reasonably priced. Maybe you have, you know, an older wine from a top grower. Maybe you have three, maybe you have four. But it seems to me 20 is just a bit of an indulgence. And it's saying the bigger the list, the better it is. And I just don't think that's true. I'd much rather the person, the sommelier or whoever put the list together, said, at the moment, these wines are drinking really well. They're covering different styles. They're covering different bases. And even have a big list up your sleeve, because you might have a customer who really would like to spend time discussing you. But I think most customers actually want to make a decision, and maybe you can help them make the decision by giving them a selection that's really good.
No, I agree with that, actually. I like looking through wine lists, don't get me wrong. It's quite good fun, but after I've got something to drink.
Exactly. I mean, some years ago I worked with a Dorchester and they had a big Bible list. They had something like, I think there were 600 bins, which isn't that big these days, but you know, it was still quite big. And I really thought it was intimidating. And they had a couple of restaurants that were, one was the Grill, which was very focused on British cooking, so good fish and good meat, and you know. and they had a Cantonese restaurant called The Oriental, which had a Michelin star. And I said, why don't we do a 40-bin list for each of those two restaurants with a focus on wines that we think will work? And so with the grill, and actually, yeah, this is 10 years ago or so, we put a maximum price of £100 a bottle. Because that's, particularly at lunchtime, you know, that's what people want. Yep. So we had 15 whites, 25 reds. You know, we had some classic. We had some Bordeaux. We had some Burgundy. We had, you know, single vineyard Valpolicella from Allegrini Lagrola, which was maybe a little bit left field for some people, but actually, you know, a little bit of a lighter style, quite smooth, quite accessible. Obviously, some Chablis and things in the whites. And it worked really well. And with the Oriental, we had 25 whites and 15 reds. You know, I would argue that Cantonese food probably suits white wines better, and maybe with aromatic varieties in particular. But we didn't go overboard with that. You know, because the truth is, if somebody wants to drink class growth claret with their dim sum, I'm not going to tell them they can't.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I don't. And in fact, we had a big thing with the sommeliers that they should present the short list alongside the main list. So we're not saying you can't have these wines. We're saying, here's a selection for you. And it worked really well. It was really successful, and I was really proud of that, because I wanted people to have an easy
experience. Yeah.
And it also, actually, funny enough, gave us the chance to showcase wines that were a little bit interesting and different, because just by the fact there were only 40 on the list, it meant they didn't get lost. Whereas with the 600 bin list, a lot of people would just automatically go to Burgundy or go to Bordeaux or go to somewhere where they felt comfortable, wouldn't look at the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was great. And that's the kind of thing I want to do, is to make wine more accessible for people.
Okay. Who do you work for now?
I work with an Indian restaurant called Quilon, which has a Michelin star, and they don't want to have a sommelier. So the restaurant manager tends to sell the wine, but the staff also are trained. So, and we have a list there. Explicitly, we're not looking for single matches of dishes and wines, because that's not how people eat there. So we look for wines that we think will be broadly successful with spicy Indian food. And there's a bit of a southern Indian bias there. So there are quite a lot of Italian white wines, mostly unoaked, you know, the Falanghina, Fiano, things like that, that I think work really well with that food. I work with the Great Northern Hotel in King's Cross. They've got a restaurant there called Plum and Spilt Milk. And again, it's not a big list. We have a slowly sort of rotating selection. No, we don't radically change it. You know, we stick with what people like. I work with Lobos, which is a couple of fantastic Spanish tapas bars.
Mm-hmm.
I work with the RAC, the club, the members
club.
And various other things from time to time.
Okay. Do you find all those restaurants sound reasonably high-end at the moment? What about, like, at the moment, the casual dining seems to be struggling quite a bit. Prezzo announced today they're going to shut like something like 100 shops, 100 restaurants.
Yeah, I that's a frustration for me, because I think that, first of all, it's actually quite difficult getting people to pay for wine consultancy. So, you know, I understand that. You know, it's a cost, and people think, why should I pay it? And it's actually sometimes difficult to prove that you're adding value. And I think I do. I'm fairly confident I do. But a lot of the time when people use me, there's an element of trust. Like, they've made a decision to use me and they believe it's working. But it's not often it's actually tested. I mean, funny enough, I do some work with Camino, which is another small Spanish group. And I don't choose this, but I train their staff. And they actually make a point of looking at sales figures and looking at, you know, uplift on glass sales and to try and track the effect of their training.
Yeah.
And they're pretty happy with what we do. So that's great. I mean, it's really great. I mean, coming back to casual dining, I would say one of the problems they have is they're like many people in the on-trade sector, they're obsessed with gross profit percentage margin pricing.
Yeah, yeah.
And what that means, for me, GP is an accountant's tool that's become a policy tool, and I think that's wrong. I don't have any problem with people using that to measure, but it's this obsession that in central London that you have to have at least 65% GP, which is effectively a three times markup. But a lot of people, particularly at the top end, are looking at 80%. And in fact, when I say top end, I would include some casual dining. And I think there's this sense, oh yeah, we can mark up five times because we can, and we need the money because maybe we're not making enough money on food. But what that means is, I think that you actively discourage people from trading up.
Yep.
Because you're talking about multiples.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're almost forcing people to drink cheaper wines. And I don't understand why people don't see that cash margins are something that you put in the bank. You can have a fantastic theoretical percentage margin, but you don't bank that. You bank cash.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you look, for example, you could say, well, what's our average cash margin on a bottle of wine? Say it's £15. If you can get that up, that average up to £17 or £18, that's money you're putting in the bank.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I've sort of almost always lost that argument with clients, and it's quite frustrating because I think people will spend a bit more money if they perceive that they're value. Getting value.
I'm the same. I will look at a wine list and I quite have a beer because I quite like beer. If they've got better wines that aren't three or five times markup, and I can see that, I'm more likely to purchase a higher end wine than an entry level wine or a beer or something like that. If I'm
and I think people obsess about, you know, again, maybe at the higher end of the market, the top end of the market, people obsess about expensive wines. It's the kind of wines that get coverage in the press, well, certainly in specialist press. And it's the kind of thing sommeliers talk about. But the truth is, most people aren't spending £200 on a bottle of wine or even 100. I would say my impression in London would be, you know, £70 is quite near the top for the vast majority of customers. But in fact, there are a lot of people still spending less than that. So it seems to me if you could, you know, as a business, if you can shift your average spend on a bottle of wine from £35 to £45, that's got to be good for your business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One question just on suppliers for the restaurants.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you go to a new restaurant, do you take suppliers with you or do you work with their current suppliers or is it a bit of both?
A bit of both. My view is there are very few people I would say, oh, I can't work with them. There are companies I think do a really good job, and it's not just about wine selection, it's about service, because to be honest, people who use me as a consultant don't want complications, so they want good service. You know, there's an old line about the right wine in the right place at the right time at the right price. So essentially you have to get your delivery right, so you can't deliver during service, you have to deliver it when they want it. You have to invoice correctly, which sounds really obvious, but it's amazing how often people don't. Either they get the price wrong or the discount wrong or the whatever. And if you can just line up those things, that's actually really important in terms of service. So, you know, I can think of one or two companies who have really interesting wines, but their service is less good. And, you know, sometimes maybe I'm less inclined to use them.
Yeah.
I always ask if I'm going to work with somebody who's already got a business up and running, I'll always say, well, who do you use and are you happy with them? Because I think if they have a relationship, I'm really happy to work with them. If they're happy. And then, you know, maybe there's a discipline about not having too many suppliers. You know, I know a sommelier who told me once he had 72 suppliers, which I thought was making a rod for his own back.
Yeah, yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't have many clients if that's what I did. So I think sometimes you have to make a slight compromise. You could say, I really, really want to have, I don't know, Daubenas Chablis. You know, that's the best Chablis, you could say. But if that's the only wine I'm going to buy from that supplier, then it doesn't work. So maybe you go, well, there are other pretty good suppliers of producers of Chablis, so maybe I'll opt for one of those from this supplier who also has wines B, C, and D that I want to use.
Mm.
So it's, you know, there's an element of realism about it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned discounts. Do like we get discounts from all our suppliers as well, because we buy from, you know, like Bibendum and Alice and all sorts of people. How much do people discount off their price?
Because, it depends.
Yeah.
There are companies who more or less don't, unless maybe they have a big chunk of the business. But I can think of people who don't discount or don't publicly discount. And I can think of other companies who routinely discount. So you look at the list and you know that the list price is not the real price, that they will give, they will knock off 5, 10, 15% without, almost without you asking. And I kind of, and of course, again, that's something that some clients are quite obsessed about, is getting a discount. And I think, but what's the real value? Like if somebody prices fairly and says, we don't discount, then maybe that's the company to use.
For sure.
Rather than someone whose prices are high and they give you a discount
just to get automatically.
Yeah. And so, yes, you can say, oh, well, we get a better discount from this company. But actually, are you getting a better deal? And that's not always clear to people, I'd say.
We get some of our suppliers give discounts and some of them don't. And ultimately, when I'm choosing a wine, it comes down to, all right, by the time I've worked out the margin, is this a £10 bottle of wine or is it a...
Exactly. So you look at when I'm putting a wine list together, I'm looking for different prices and different styles, and I know that, for example, what's an example? Say Rioja. You could put a red Rioja on a list, and if it's too cheap, you won't sell anything else. And so maybe say I need to buy something, a better example, maybe a Reserva rather than a Crianza or something like that. You're not ripping the customer off, but you're expecting to pay more for something that's better. And for the customer that wants value, you can give them a Garnacha Tempranillo blend from
Navarra. Yeah,
that fits that the same price slot as the cheap Rioja. And I think you're probably offering the customer better value for money in both slots.
Yeah,
because you're getting the Rioja lookalike that's value for money, probably better than the cheap Rioja.
Yep.
And then someone who really wants a good quality Rioja should be happy, if you've done your job properly, paying more because they're getting better wine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right then, Peter. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Good. Fantastic.